Acquisition number 11938, Reel 36.
Mr. G. Iston, Reel 36. On reaching the Alamein positions, Mr. Iston, what condition was the battalion in?
Well, we drove through the Alamein positions, I think maybe 6 or 8 miles, to El Amon Station. And then we went south into the desert again. It's pretty well all desert, but there is a little bit of green on the seaward side of the road, and it is quite attractive, but we didn't stay there. We went back into the desert again. And we came into a big a dish in the desert, and it was seemed to be swarming with people. They're all well dispersed, but it seemed to be swarming with people and vehicles. And I suppose really that this was a brigade lager rather than battalion lager. It was well dished, and we're covered in from the sides. But of course, anything from the air could see us. That's why we were well dispersed and netted as far as we possibly could be netted.
When you say netted, what do you mean by that?
Camouflage nets, so that we're not so easily seen from the sky. And actually, when you get in a desert situation like that, very often it is purely the net and a few strips of sacking through, because the net is the colour of the sand. So it's not a camouflage net the way we'd have one in Europe, where you've got a green net with green and brown, what they call stuff, might come to the name, might come, scrim, going through it. And the net is sort of lattied, a bit like woven. It's in and out, and you've got these strips of scrim going through. But on the desert, it was just a matter of tearing a few sacks up and putting the sack through, and that acted as the camouflage. Now, once behind the minefield, the tension went. It was like being in the box. Once you got back in the box of Ghazala, the tension left you a little bit, because there was somebody else taking the strain, as you might say. There was somebody in front of you listening.
Had there been any attempts when you got back to tell you that that was as far as you were going?
Not really. We were well behind the line, and I suppose that we were thinking that we would stop there and rebuild and reform and re-equip. Frankly, all we wanted to do was to get a good sleep.
There's no thought that Rommel may not be stopped and may still come through.
I suppose soldiers are optimistic, and it's these things that never strike you. For all we'd had our shocks at Arras and in France and at Ghazala. I mean, we'd had, and at Mersey. By this time, we'd certainly had some shocks. But I suppose, really speaking, a soldier is always optimistic. And no, I don't think we had any fears that we're going back any further. We'd got there midday, I suppose, and had a meal. And that was a great thing. I don't know that we got washed. I think we just had a meal and sort of collapsed and got some sleep. Now, I don't know. Certainly no common sheep who went off. You see, we're there. Midday is the heat of the sun and siesta time in normal Mediterranean language. It's siesta time. So there's no problem of going to sleep in any case, because if it was at all possible, we'd have a sleep at that time of the day to conserve our moisture content and to keep out the heat as much as possible. You'd get down underneath a vehicle if possible, or in the shade of something, and you would have a sleep midday. You'd have a siesta, just like a Mediterranean person would do. And that's what happened to us.
I think you said this was the 30th of June.
Yes, somewhere in that region anyway. Yes, 30th of June. When we got there, and I don't know how long I was asleep, but I do know I was rudely awakened during the afternoon told that I was going back in the Alamein line with the company. Then, I suppose, you do start to take stock. I mean, if you can think now, I've been something like 2 months with hardly any sleep. And having got to sleep with a contented mind, I mean, all we're really frightened of there was planes coming over and bombing, which that was a normal occurrence now. I suppose it's like the London Blitz. You didn't take any notice of it unless you got hit. So really speaking, we're contented and we're sleeping the sleep of the just, as they would say, in some cases. Anyway, we're sound asleep. And then I was rudely awakened and we're told I was going back into the Alamein line with one of the companies.
Which company was this?
I think it was D Company. I seem to spend a lot of time with it during the from Gazala. I seem to spend a lot of time with D Company. Whether that was the only complete company that we had, or they had the most men and equipment, I don't know, but I seem to spend quite a lot of time with it. I'm almost certain it was D Company, but I wouldn't swear to it. And we went back in the line to plug a gap which had been left. Well, I don't know why it had been left, but there was a gap there, and we went in and laying mines. And I remember thinking that the mines weren't in any pattern, which they were in a pattern, in a minefield pattern, if you know what I mean. But the mines seemed to be going north and south, east and the lines of mines seemed to be going all over, rather than if you've got a line, you'd expect the lines, sort of a line north to south, you'd expect the mines going north to south. But these weren't. They were going behind us and on the side of us and all over. And it looked as though we were mining any high ground. So that if the armour did manage to get round the bottom of us again, for all we knew the line was going right down to the Katara Depression, which was almost impossible. In fact, I would say it was impossible. With the type of vehicles at that stage, if it happened today, I suppose we've got what we call light load-bearing track layers, which would go over the sand. But in those days, I don't think there's anything that would have got over the sand. I believe on one stage, the long-range desert group did get something across, but they had a load of trouble, and they decided it was more or less impossible. And these mines were just laid, they weren't just laid, they were laid to the mine pattern for a mine field. But they didn't seem to have any direction, if you know what I'm trying to say. They seemed to go all over, round us more or less.
Had the pattern of laying mines changed over the period of time?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not that I'm aware of. What about the mines? Were they still the same type?
I've got a feeling that by the time we got to Alamein, that we'd got some German telemines, which were sort of a very heavy anti-tank mine. And I think there's some of these being laid in among the minefield. Why, I don't really know, but possibly that we'd left, you see, we'd mined at Gazala, we'd mined at Tobruk, we'd mined at Matru. And other people have been doing the same things in other parts of the desert. So possibly it was a short of our own mines at this stage. And there was one or two of the bigger German mines going down. I seem to remember that.
Were you mining with the engineers? Or was this an action that you could do now without that help?
By now, we were developing sort of an assault pioneer platoon. The engineers were there as well. There were some engineers up with us. Well, they weren't our engineers, but there were engineers in the district. The South Africans and the New Zealanders had established part of the line. And I think it was the 5th Indian Div which had come back up to dig the trenches and things like that. And we'd gone back to reinforce it. So there would be REs and Royal Engineers there, sappers, as well as ourselves. But by this time, we were getting really into the S Company side of things. Now, I believe that there was a small detachment of what we call assault pioneers. There was a pioneer platoon with battalion headquarters which did the the woodwork, make the latrines and things like this. And then we were developing these mine sweeping and mine laying people. And it was also about this time, I think, where they were bringing in the bang. Can't remember the name of it now. Anyway, the sausage mine, which went underneath the Dannat wire and blew the Dannat wire apart. Dannat wire was coils of wire. And these were laid sort of one coil and then another coil beside it, maybe another coil on the side of that, and then another two coils in the junctions between the three bottom ones and then one on the top. So it stood something like 4 or 5 feet high and maybe 6 or 8 feet across. And these were
Bangalore torpedoes.
But that's right. That's the thing. And they were developing these and they were learning to use these. At that time, maybe not just at this particular time, but at Alamein they were learning these things, and we're also learning about some of the fantastic booby traps which were being left behind by the Italians. They'd really got a grip of it. The Italians were worse than the Germans for their booby mines, and so we were. Everybody was sort of learning about mines, in a sense, and booby traps, because the booby traps did cost us quite heavily in some places after the Alamein.
And you were learning techniques of discovering booby traps?
Discovering them. We were learning to leave things alone, basically.
What kind of things were you being taught not to?
Oh, it could be a cigarette packet. It could be a nice Bible. And once you lift open the Bible out, it was hollowed out. It was a lovely Bible on the floor, but as soon as you opened it out, it was hollow, and of course, the flash was straight in your face. The cigarette packet was a great one, a box of matches. Anything. You can't imagine it. A tin of beans or something like that, it would be turned upside, it'd been opened and turned upside down, and you go and pick it up, and of course, the whole thing just blows up in your hand, full of, might even be full of nails. Ball bearings or anything that could get shot of. It would be packed with these things. Similar, I suppose, to the sort of thing that the IRA are doing today. But this would just be a tin. Look, it looks like a perfectly good tin of beans. Or it wouldn't be beans in this case. It'd be ravioli or something like that. And it would be standing up there quite sound in the ground. And, of course, as soon as you lifted it up, you just flew up, and all these ball bearings and anything that was there flew all around you, in your face or anywhere.
The basic instruction was not to touch.
Not to touch. If you want to touch, which in some cases you had to, for instance, if you wanted to be in a vehicle or something like that and you saw something suspicious, you would try and lasso it or get the rifle and bayonet very often and try and move it with a rifle and bayonet before you got anywhere, you know, at arm's length, as far as you could get away from it, you would find whatever you could to try and dislodge before you try to get into the vehicle.
So the smallest item, your cigarette packets and things like this, would basically blow a hand off? Or
oh, yes. Yes, and if it was in your face, of course, your eyes could go. You see, it might not go just you pick it up, but even if just you pick it up, you're stooping down to lift it. And of course, the eyes are the thing. I mean, once your eyes are gone, you're no more use to the army, are you? You're no more use to the fighting forces. And there was all sorts of these things. But this was mainly after Alamein, when they were on the way back. And I suppose, really speaking, it was people a long way back from the line who had time to lay these things. I don't know whether they caught any of their own soldiers on the way back or not, because if they were hungry, they'd just love to get a hold of a tin of ravioli or whatever it was on the laid on the desert. And you see, it was always in, very often anyway, it was in one of their headquarters, which they'd deserted. They'd had to pull away sharp. So obviously these things had been done, and then when the time arose that they had to pull out, they were just there ready and primed and left waiting for us to go in.
And I know, it's, as you say, it's in advance of what we're talking about now, but What was the normal soldier's response to this? Was it anger?
Oh, yes.
Let me
get at the bastards, you know. I'll give them what for when I catch up with them, kind of thing. Having said that, of course, once they'd said it, the thing was forgotten because the soldier that it happened to would be taken back, but his mates would be certainly angry. But it soon leaves. And I don't know that there's any repercussions taken through it. There could have been, but there's nothing that I know of that there was any repercussions taken. There was one thing I can mention, I think. We took General's headquarters, I think it was close to Eldaba, and we went in to look around and see what there was, and we got quite a good lot of looting out. But at 3 o'clock the next morning, I had to go out and take everything off, have a bath and start afresh. It was absolutely full of fleas. And a lot of the lads were taking these silk underwear and silk pyjamas, because silk's nice in the desert. I mean, let's not mistake it. It's puffish, but silk is nice in the desert because it slides with your body a bit, rather than cotton tends to get damp and hang and stick to your body. And eventually it does become sore if you've got to wear the same thing for quite a while. So silk is quite nice if you can get it. But we raided, we didn't raid it, we had to go to see what there was and make sure there was nobody left. And we were looking for vehicle parts, really. But while we were doing so, we did go in among the officers' valises and things like this. And we finished up with fleas properly. I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I would strip everything off, have a bath in the cold. It was cold as well.
While we're on the subject of
well, that's ahead.
While we're on the subject of looting, was it frowned upon? Did the officers try to stop you from doing it?
I don't recall any problems of looting from the enemy. Looting from property, private property, they were definitely frowned upon. But I don't think, I mean, I would say that in some cases you were slightly encouraged, because if you found water, obviously you're going to take it, and petrol. And I mean, if you were short of ammunition or something like that, and you can find a pea shooter with a lot of peas, you're going to take it and use it, because the further you get away from your own supplies, the more difficult it becomes to get the supplies. And I mean, if one of the lads at Mersa, he fired his Bren gun solitary for an hour. Now, I don't forget, I think there's 28 rounds in a magazine. You can get through a magazine in about 3 minutes. After 10 magazines, you change the barrel. So you can understand that for an hour shooting, he's getting through some ammunition. And if you can find another, what we used to try and get if we could, I think I'd have mentioned it anyway, was take the Espana guns, the German Espana, because they were air-cooled, and they didn't heat up the way that ours did. But then, of course, you've got to find the ammunition to go with them, otherwise the gun's useless. So, yes, we're kind of encouraged to loot in that respect, but not from civilians.
What about,
I mean, like in France, looting was definitely frowned upon. For all it was just there for taking, and I often think now that maybe we're fools because the Germans would have taken it when they went through, but definitely frowned upon where the civilian was involved. Looting from bodies, I think in the case of where a body was going to be buried, the watches and rings would be taken off. They should be taken with the soldier's documents and anything that's with him, but I don't know. I wouldn't like to say that it wasn't taken into somebody's pocket. I think I've heard of a few cases where it was, but how much, I don't know.
What about looting from prisoners?
Now, from prisoners, no, I don't think so. Binoculars we're always on the lookout for, if anybody had binoculars, because that wasn't a personal thing. It was a... You see, you've got to have this difference of a... If it was an army thing, it was a prize of war. Like we know it in the Crimea, they took drums. Well, you could say that was looting in a sense, but it wasn't. It was from the enemy. So that was a prize of war. Just like Raleigh used to take ships. There were prizes of war. And I think the same thing goes, but not personal things, except, as I've just said, in the case of a dead man, I can't imagine him being buried with his watch and his rings on. Now, as I said, those things should have gone with his personal property, but who's to know? So I wouldn't like to say that wasn't done.
What part of the line were you sent to?
That I can't really remember. I think it was sort of midstream, midway down, possibly somewhere near the Alam Alfaya Ridge. In fact, it could have been on Alam Alfaya Ridge itself, because we were definitely sort of laying mines east and west. So that looks as though it could have been. It was a ridge similar to that, where we're preparing for somebody coming around the south again, like they did at Gazala, like they did at Tobruk. It was a defence. And although Montgomery says that he wanted a fortnight to square things up when he came before the Germans attacked, which he did get as it happened, he used Auchinleck's defence scheme pretty soundly. He had a big idea of himself, Montgomery. Of course, there was a bit of a conflict between Montgomery and Auchinleck, because they'd had a do in France, I believe, and also when they came back to England after France, after Dunkirk.
Was this obvious to you people at the time, in the period of time between coming into the line whilst Auchinleck was there and then Montgomery came taking over? Was it obvious to you then that he was using Auchinleck's plans, or was this something you read afterwards?
Well, we knew that. I mean, we were already laying these mines, and I think it was Alamann Fire, where Auchinleck obviously expected him to come round too, and that was going to be the line of defence when he did come. I mean, he was going to let him come round. We used the same scheme at Gazala, where we allowed him to come round, and we did the same thing. But, as I did say at Gazala, our main tank was the Grant, which was too high, and the gun was too low.
How long were you doing this work?
Somewhere about 4 days.
And then you were pulled back?
And then we were pulled back. And by this time, the battalion had gone to the Ella Amaria area. Now, I did say when we were going up the desert with the transport that we'd pulled into El Amaria, and we couldn't see a thing for the Ghibli. The Ghibli being a sandstorm, hot, very hot sandstorm, where the sand really pitters into your face when it comes along. And we're in this area again. Not exactly in El Amaria, because that's a hell of a big place. It was a massive camp. Or it had been a massive camp. It was defunct, really, by the time we got there. And, of course, with things moving, the El Amaria staging area, it was probably at its strongest at the time of the Wavell retreat, when Wavell came back, because they dropped right back almost to the border off Fire Pass, Fort Capuso. And so that had been the strongest then. As we went up, that was really in full go. And by the time we got back again, it seemed as though it had been more or less abandoned. There were one or two wooden huts, one or two broken down corrugated shacks, a few remnants of Indian tents, a few bivouacs. But by the time we got back 4 days later, the lads had pretty well got dug in. And there were back into the dugouts as near as possible.
Not, the dugouts, not tents?
Well, actually, it was a spit trench with a sheet over the top, more or less. A bit more than a slip trench, as deep as you could get. You see, you couldn't, there's places where you can't get very deep. And again, you see, in his book, you read later, Montgomery said that we were digging defences for the fall back onto the to the Delta. And that Auchinleck had plans to take his army back beyond Cairo and away up the Nile. Well, that was all false, of course, because by the time we got back, the Air Force had back. And all the way around us. Oh, I don't know how many there were. I should think there was something like 10 airfields around, right round us. Because all the Desert Air Force had to drop back just the way we had. And they'd accumulated round there. So actually, we were there to defend the airstrips against paratroops, which we fully expected would be the next stage. If he was held at Alamein, and we had no reason to believe that he wouldn't be held there, we expected a paratroop drop, which was a natural thing to do, you would think. So, again, I'll dispute Montgomery's theory on this. I'm no general, but I mean, having read his book afterwards, it did get me quite wild, I must admit.
Had you received reinforcements in, or replacements for your losses?
Oh, no. We were some 4 days later, that after the battalion getting back, and we were very depleted in men, vehicles, weapons, depleted in everything. We had had a small draft of light infantrymen from all the Cornwalls, the Oxenbucks, the KSLI, you know, a real old mixture. And I suppose these had come from the depot, which at that time was really Geneva, on the Suez Canal. And while we're talking in Geneva, I had to go back there a couple of times and to pick vehicles up. Down there, the South Africans had built a conveyor belt. And again, Geneva being on the canal, the stuff was coming up the canal. Sort of at one end of this conveyor belt, there was massive boxes. Oh, I should think they were maybe 30 feet long by 8 feet wide, 8 feet deep. Massive things, they were massive crates. And these boxes were dropped on the end of the conveyor belt, and the top knocked off and the sides dropped down. And then the parts were lifted out and put on the conveyor belt in the right order. And the next, at the other end, you've got a 30-ton Mack or a 30-ton White or a Chevrolet or, you know, you've got a massive truck coming off the other end out of this box. Sometimes they were packed so you got sort of, in three boxes, you might get five vehicles, depending on the size, but oh, they were massive things. And just like the containers that we see today, possibly even bigger than the containers that we see today that go on the container ships. And the South Africans, they were doing a great job there, turning this stuff out. And I stayed with them for 2 days, and I got to know some of them quite well. And this company was actually part of the South African Railways. And for all I didn't realise at the time, that some years later after the war, I was going to work for the company that built the South African Railways, Balfour Beatty. They were a British company which had built the railway in South Africa, and they had trained these men to in the South African workshops. So it was quite funny, really, that I should go and work with them. And they talked about Balfour Beatty quite a lot at that time. I didn't even know them.
When you saw this kind of thing going on, did that give you the feeling that things were changing?
Yes.
That we were getting equipment.
Yes. In fact, again, we didn't know this at the time. But we were beginning to see while we were in the while I was down on the canal, Churchill had been in America at the time, having a conference with Roosevelt when Tobruk had fallen. And according to the papers, Roosevelt had seen the look on Churchill's face, and he'd offered to refit the 8th Army with 300 Sherman tanks, 100 self-propelled 105mm guns, and he even replaced the engines of the 300 tanks which had been torpedoed off Bermuda. The Sherman was a real tank. I know the Grant was a good tank, but it was more of an howitzer tank than the Sherman was. The Sherman Mark IV was a 31-ton tank with a long-barreled 75mm gun. Now, the gun of this one was in the turret, so the tank was much shorter in height than the Grant. And, of course, you could travel the 75mm gun in a 360-degree circle, which meant even if you were running away, you would still be firing at the enemy, whereas the Grant, you had to have the tank lined up before you could shoot the howitzer.